Welcome to the Ortho Joe Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Well, good afternoon, Mark. How are you? Thanks for changing the time. Today's a bit of a late afternoon coffee break, if it's that. I don't have a coffee with me, but that would be the premise anyway.
Well, I don't have a coffee with me either. I've got some hot tea because it just now reached zero for the first time in 3.5 days here in Minnesota. It is that time of year when one wonders why one lives here and tries to remember what it feels like in August when it's beautiful without much success. So,
well, Canada became Canada last couple of days. We've hit this polar vortex, which has definitely dropped temperatures. And yeah, I mean, I think they've had some of the coldest daytime temperatures in recent history. So that's something to think about anyways. For those of you planning your winter vacation in Canada.
That's right. I'm going to do one of those ice plunges with you.
Oh, there you go.
To warm up.
I'll save it for you for sure.
It was minus 23 Fahrenheit this morning when I woke up.
Oh, that's pretty cold.
Yeah,
that's cold. Very cold.
I really wanted to talk about something that got me heated up. And I think the audience knows that I really don't have much experience personally outside of trauma surgery, but I have followed the whole issue of PRP injections for knee OA as well as other conditions. And what just came out in the, not in the JBJS, but in the American Journal of Sports Medicine just this month, was a systematic review on the use of PRP in knee osteoarthritis. A huge work with 5 databases looking at initially over 5,500 articles, 18 randomized controlled trials in nearly 2,000 patients, primarily placebo controlled, and PRP presented statistically superior improvements in the VAS and WOMAC scores exceeding the MCID at 3 and 6 month follow-up for VAS and all follow-up points for WOMAC. So this fueled my recollection of when the reports first started to be submitted to our journal with not only stem cells, but also PRP. And the whole issue of the fact that in the vast majority of these submissions, how the preparations are made and handled and what is actually in them is nowhere in the manuscript. And that has led to really, I think, a delay in progress in this whole field. And when I brought this up to you, you suggested we have a special guest. So I'll let you introduce our special guest, who's very knowledgeable about this.
Absolutely. And our special guest has been with us before talking about a host of issues. But Dr. Mohan Khan is an associate professor at McMaster University and has been doing research on evidence-based reviews. Particularly, he would have a good insight on the idea of systematic reviews and meta-analysis and the challenges that they face, Mark. So welcome to you, Mohan. And before I get started, I just want to give you sort of an overview. So at Ortho Evidence, for example, we did do a review of popular articles of 2024. And every year for the past 3 or 4 years, a PRP or PRP-focused article always gets into that top 10 list. And this last year, it was PRP, not in this case, not related to knee, but related to shoulder. So you're also seeing the evaluation of PRP across a variety of various indications. And so there were a couple. The other big thing around PRP that we notice is that, you know, there's a leukocyte poor and a leukocyte rich. So there's been trials evaluating both of those. But I will tell you that there's also an area that I think is largely underrepresented in the literature. And it's also the control. What are we comparing it to? And I think all of that stuff matters as well. I wonder from your take, Mohan, just generally, when you think about the PRP literature, what's your overall, you know, general take of that literature and where do you feel the challenges are?
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Mo, for inviting me and Mark as well. Always a pleasure to join. You know, PRP is such a hot topic, orthobiologics in general, with the idea of using your body's own regeneration to fuel and heal yourself. So there's so much popularity, and it's estimated that, you know, conservatively, hundreds of millions of dollars a year are being spent in PRP and orthobiologics. So There's a huge interest in regenerative medicine and orthobiologics, and the field is moving so quickly and it's just developing and the evidence is trying to catch up. There's PRP, stem cell research, various different formulations, exosomes people are talking about now. And so there's a lot of stuff that we're learning, but there's a lot of stuff that we don't know. And I think that really gets to the heart of the matter. And like you're mentioning, you know, there's so many different types of formulations. We looked at this a number of years ago. There are more than 40 different types of PRP systems on the market. And that was, you know, a few years ago. And each one of them have differences in PRP concentrations, the amount of blood they're taking, whether the platelets are activated, non-activated, leukocyte-rich, leukocyte-poor formulations, you know, the amount of leukocytes, the number of injections. And so there's so many variables in what is called PRP that it is difficult when you're looking at the literature to really figure out, okay, what did we actually study and where is the signal, where is the effect coming from? You know, what's interesting is, you know, I was reading in 2017, Jorge Chala out of Rush, he wrote a good paper published in JBJS. He looked at a number of PRP trials that were available at the time and found that only 10% reported clear descriptions of PRP protocols and only 17% really actually explained what the composition of PRP was. So I think this really gets to why we see a lot of this heterogeneity in the literature.
I just wanted to ask, Moin, if you thought that it's improving, people are reporting more the details of the material.
I think there is certainly increased awareness now from these publications that we should be doing that. I don't know if it has actually improved in recent years. And I think, you know, it certainly is an area that is open to research and open to review and see if there's actually been an improvement since this original paper a number of years ago.
Yeah, that would be a good project that I think the new editor of JBJS might be interested in receiving a manuscript. I'm not sure, but I'll ask him next time I see him.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, you should ask. Yeah, I'm positive he would be interested. But let me ask you another broader question. Placebos in general, right? So we always take it this idea of the control being, you know, hugely important. In fact, I think there are discussions at the FDA now, right, where they say, well, there are some things that we want, but we want an appropriate control. Placebo may not be the appropriate control if that's not, quote, the standard of care anymore. So what is that standard? But let's just take a step back to the idea of a placebo. Placebos come in all shapes and sizes, right? You can have topical, you know, pastes. You know, when we're talking about knee osteoarthritis, you can have an oral medication that you can take for osteoarthritis. And you can have injectable placebos. Are they all the same? Like, do they all kind of have the same impact? Should we be thinking about them differently? And when you think about PRP, it has some additional complexity, I think. And I wonder what your take on that is, Moin.
Yeah, I think the placebo aspect is very, very interesting. We know from the surgical literature, the more invasive a procedure is, the more the placebo effect is. And even just looking at the HA literature and network meta-analysis, we know that there's obviously an active component effect and then the placebo effect that's added on top of that. And surprisingly, even just the injection of just the needle itself has a strong placebo effect that can be more than many oral anti-inflammatory medications. But what's unique with PRP is I think there's also the psychological component that could play a role. A lot of these systems, you can actually view the preparation, the spinning of the PRP, the separation of the blood components, drawing it up. And all of that has an impact on a patient's psyche. And I think that has a placebo effect as well. And I don't think we know what that effect is. And I think all of these effects combined together obviously have a true treatment effect and it'd be very interesting to quantify that.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, like there's definitely got to be some impact to walking into a place, you know, simple things, wearing a stethoscope, you know, you can argue wearing a coat or not, but I think there is, you know, why is it that almost every advertisement for a drug has a physician in a white lab coat and a stethoscope, because somehow that means they're just more trustworthy. I believe what they're going to give me is going to work. Mm-hmm. And I know they've looked at that in that case, but with PRP, you have the injection effect itself. So let's say you didn't see anything, but then you've got the ultracentrifuge. You've got, you know, the vial where you're showing the layer. Imagine doing that whole routine, so to speak, in front of a patient. I have to believe all of that cumulatively does have you know, a perception that this is going to work. I feel good about this working. Now, a proper trial would rule that out, and a proper placebo would truly rule that out. I am curious how, quote, the placebo trials in the study Mark mentioned were actually done. How was the placebo for a PRP actually conducted? Because you got to unpack a lot there, I think, if you want to do it properly.
Yeah, well, I don't really know about, I didn't obviously go through the trials that composed the meta-analysis, which included placebo. But really what we're talking about is blinding. The factors involved with blinding a placebo-controlled trial are huge, not to mention the fact that in the majority of instances in the United States, patients are paying out of pocket large volumes of money, which I can imagine can only positively influence the placebo effect as well. So it's a basic principle of blinding. I can imagine a trial where the centrifuge is in a remote room, the syringe is, you know, covered with tape so you can't see what's in it, and the patients aren't charged for the service. You know, I think you could do very high level blinding. I'm just not sure that it's been done in any of these trials.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, and to go back to the, I think, Moen, you had actually just alluded to a paper from Banneru, I think you were getting at Annals of Internal Medicine back in 2015. That's kind of the time, right? Right around the time where injectables were going through all kinds of, the HAs for sure were going through all kinds of controversy around, you know, what's the evidence? And so the network meta-analysis became very popular around 2015. It seems like, I can't believe it's 10 years ago already, but, you know, just seems like yesterday. But anyways, 10 years ago that they became popular. And Ravi Banneru was very, very clear on trying to use the network meta-analysis tool to actually be able to uncover the placebo effect. And to your point, he actually gave estimates. So he said that using an injectable, like so just the injection itself with no, quote, therapeutic drug inside or medication inside, the injection itself, the needle poke, had a moderate effect size, an effect size that was actually greater than taking an oral NSAID. And then he also said that actually taking the topical corticosteroid or topical cream visibly had a greater effect than an oral medication. So he talked a lot about, you know, the idea that, you know, what we should be thinking about carefully adjusting for these effects, because that is a pretty substantial effect. So, for example, comparing an oral medication to an injectable, there's a different effect already. So there's a bias built into the fact that one's injected and one isn't. And there's going to be, if nothing else was the same, the injection's going to work no matter what you put in it, because it's you've already got the boost. You've already got a moderate effect size just from the injection itself. And that, I think, is really important, you know, when we think about these active trials. And I think that's where, when you get into the larger clinical trial programs, and I don't think we've seen any, like, I don't know what the largest PRP trial was in that meta-analysis, that one that you quoted, Mark, in American Journal of Sports Medicine, but I would gather that there haven't been trials in the 500 to 600 patient level at all. They've probably been much smaller, and the effects they're seeing sometimes are pretty, pretty big, and sometimes the effects they're seeing are pretty small. And that may also be a factor, right, around the noise in the system.
One thing I've noticed in a lot of the meta-analysis I've looked at is there's so much heterogeneity, like the I-squared value is sky high. And I think it gets to the point, Mark, that you were making earlier about all the various controls that you're looking at, whether it's placebo, whether it's cortisone or other active comparators, or what type of formulations we're looking at. And so it's very difficult to figure out, you know, what signal we're trying to find.
Yeah, I was just trying to tease through that article, but I only had the abstract to look at, so I can't answer the question about the largest trial.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, I would guess that we're not getting into the 500 to 600 range. There might be one or two out there, but I think mostly they're under 500 patients.
Which I would think so. Yeah, I would think so, because it's only 1,995 patients total from the 18 RCTs. So,
well, there you go, right? So they're probably in the 100 to 50 range, right? For the most part, which in and of itself is a major problem, right? When you're thinking of trying to make inferences from very small trials in general, right? So yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I think we could keep talking about this, but ultimately I think what we need is we need to be thinking about what we can be doing to identify the methodology and clarify it and really think of the highest quality methods we can do on both sides, on the comparator side and also on delineating the active treatment itself.
Absolutely.
Mohan, do you have any trials in process or planned in this area?
Honestly, we were actually thinking of doing this sort of trial where we look at this sort of effect, the psychological effect of actually viewing the preparation of the PRP and seeing what that has on the psyche of the patient and how that correlates to outcomes.
That would be, I think, a major boost to our knowledge in this area, along with perhaps if you can use your influence, maybe both of you too, and I'll certainly do it, whatever I can, to get people to actually write in their manuscript what the material is, how it was prepared, what are the cells, what's the concentration, those level of details so we can make some progress in this field. And maybe you can find somebody that would do that updated review of how we're doing in the last 10 years since that 8 years since that 2017 publication.
Absolutely. I mean, there's lots of work to be done. So there you go, Moyne. You've got your walking papers now to go and do some stuff.
All right, sure. Here we go.
No, but thanks so much, Moyne. I appreciate it. And thank you again, Mark, for bringing another interesting discussion to light. And I think we'll be having lots more of these discussions around some of the methods. I think it's important to talk methods as well, because, you know, treatments ultimately, you know, either work or they don't, but a lot of times it's the methodology that helps us delineate whether that's true or not.
Yeah. And this is an area where I think more well-done trials are needed. If I were to think about a trial needed today for wearing gloves versus not when going outside, I don't think I need a trial to do that. Sort of like the parachute, you know, I don't think we need a trial to prove effectiveness there, but you definitely don't need one for a toque or a stocking cap or gloves or a scarf today.
Not in this one. You're a full believer. No trials needed. I got you. Well, thanks again, Moyne. Appreciate it. And thank you, Mark. Have yourself a nice late, I guess, afternoon and a good and into the evening, I guess. So hope you have a quiet evening.
Yeah. Thank you. You too.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Cheers.